How important is freedom to you? Would you rather reign in hell than serve in heaven? Because serve you will in exchange for your freedom. The mind can make a hell of heaven. And for Satan, that was his fall. But that was also his power. Freedom to choose, freedom to abuse, and freedom to seek revenge. Today we cover Paradise Lost, and our first destination is hell. Maybe you got lost somewhere, swimming too far off the beach. What's going on, everyone? Welcome to The Cause. My name is Rob, and today we crack open the fourth volume in the Harvard Classics series, where we will be discussing John Milton's Paradise Lost. Probably one of the best literary works I've read up until this point. I'm literally blown away by it. So first I want to go over how I'm going to lay the next few videos out, a little background into Paradise Lost, and then we will move into the poem itself. So Paradise Lost is separated into 12 books or chapters. I initially planned to separate the entire poem into two videos, but I decided to do six to keep the video length somewhat manageable. So in this video, we will be covering books 1 and 2. In the second video, I'll be covering books 3 and 4. And in the third video, so on, 2 books after that. I apologize for breaking it up this way, but the material is so dense and so rich that I couldn't really justify doing it any other way. So Paradise Lost is an epic poem written by John Milton. He wrote this work in English heroic verse without rhyme, very similar to the works of Homer or Virgil, who wrote in the same way. Now, Milton is blind at the time of writing this, so he would actually dictate the entire poem and have it written. I sat back and thought about this. When I write, I need to see it. I need to read over it. I need to think about it. Imagine having only to use your imagination and speech to write not just an email at work or a letter, but a complete epic poem, one that is considered one of the best, if not the best, in the entire English language. His daughter would help him write most of it, and some friends would help as well. And in this poem, you will find words that were created by Milton. Pandemonium, which is the capital of hell. The word terrific. The word unoriginal. In fact, Milton would add over 630 words to the English language, compared to his contemporary Shakespeare, who would only add around 230. Now, most epic poems are about epic heroes. So if Milton was going to try to top Virgil or Homer, what better way to do this than by telling the story of the fall of man? Creating controversy has been a tactic used by people for years to help add a certain charm to your work. And shortly after Paradise Lost was published, the church would ban it and place it on the Index Librum Prohibition. But let's be honest, that would all just make us want to read it more. Now, before we start, I would highly suggest stopping and reading Genesis chapter 3 to kind of familiarize yourself with the context of where this story kind of takes place in the Bible, especially if you're not familiar with the Christian or the Jewish religion. As we move through the individual books, I want to pull out the key ideas and explore them. Who is the hero in the poem? What is the conflict? Can we learn from Satan? What lessons can we pull from all these flawed characters? What is Milton trying to convey or prove with this work of his? So with no further ado, let's go ahead and move in to the first book. So first I'll give a synopsis of what this chapter or this book is about, and then we'll move into the poem. Right from the start, book one summarizes the entire subject of the poem briefly. Man's fall from paradise by disobeying God's orders. Satan has been driven out of heaven at this point because he revolted against God. The book begins with Satan and his corrupted angels residing in hell along a lake of fire. It's almost as if they took a long nap, because after their recovery, Satan calls them up. They discuss their fall from heaven, and he wakes his legions up from the deep. Satan gives a speech to his closest angels and mentions a new creation of God somewhere not yet confirmed. A council ensues, and they plan what they want to do next. At this point, Pandemonium, which is the palace of Satan, rises from the deep where the council is to be had. Let's begin the poem. The first line of the poem opens with clarity on what the poem is about. Of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree whose mortal taste brought death into the world and all our woe with loss of Eden till one greater man restore us and regain the blissful seat. Milton gives us the problem right off the bat. So our goal now is really trying to discover what he is trying to convey. Milton will then ask for help from the heavenly muse of God and the Holy Spirit to aid him in this adventurous song he is attempting to create. The next line illustrates the confidence Milton has in his work. To surpass anything written from Homer to Virgil. Listen here. That with no middle flight, intensity to soar above the Ionian mount while it pursues things unattempted and yet in prose or rhyme. So he's saying that he plans to write something that surpasses anything that the great writer from that area, Homer, would write. Now, what Milton writes next is what I believe is the big takeaway from the poem, because it kind of answers one of the most asked questions in Christianity. Why would God allow Satan to seduce Eve and allow man to fall? Why would God allow? Why would God not stop it? So in regards to Milton asking the muse for help, he asked to help explain this problem. Milton says, "What in me is dark? Illumine. What is low, raise and support, that to the height of this great argument, I may assert eternal providence and justify the ways of God to men." Milton moves the poem quickly into the scene of hell where Satan resides. A rebel, an outcast, a seducer of demons and mankind. His crew lays out vanquished into the fiery deep. Angrily he sits down, saddened of his defeat, raging, but also in constant pain. Milton uses the most beautiful evil language to describe this place. The place of fire, chaos, confusion, hell. A dungeon horrible, on all sides round, as one great furnace flamed, yet from those flames no light, but rather darkness visible, serve only to discover sights of woe, regions of sorrow, doleful shades, where peace and rest can never dwell. Hope never comes, that comes to all, but torture without end, still urges in a fiery deluge, fed with ever-burning sulfur, unconsumed. Visualize the language he uses here. It amazes me how he can beautifully describe a place so hideous and evil-sounding. Our next character enters the scene, and he is next in power to Satan. Beelzebub rises up beside the devil. With his entrance, Satan starts his first speech. He reminisces how he was bested, and he basically says he will never bow down. So the rebel in Satan speaks. "What? Thou the field be lost? All is not lost. The unconquerable will and study of revenge, immortal hate, and courage never to submit or yield." Beelzebub then speaks and matches Satan's thoughts. He brings up one major point and admits to the overwhelming power of God. "But what if he, our conqueror, whom I now of force believe almighty, since no less than such a power could have overpowered such force as ours, have left this our spirit and strength entire?" He is kind of saying that God may have made an error here. God won the battle, but he did not pursue the enemy to defeat. Many wars have been lost because the victor of the battle let the beaten, defeated foe regroup, regain, and reemerge. A great example is George Washington himself. After stewing in his anger, Satan says, "Farewell, happy fields, where joy forever dwells. Hell, horrors, hell, infernal world, and thou profoundest hell, receive thy new possessor, one who brings a mind not to be changed by place or time. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell out of heaven." Heaven, in a sense, was a hell for Satan. At least it was so in his mind. Satan says, "At least here we shall be free, free to live in hell as they please." There is a line coming next that is probably the most famous line in the entire poem, and most of us have heard about it before. "Here we may reign secure, and in my choice, to reign is worth ambition, though in hell, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven." This part of the poem reminds me of Patrick Henry's famous speech at the Virginia Convention. "Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not course what others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death." Like the devil, man has always cherished his liberty. Freedom, even if in pursuit of his own ambition, is greater than serving something you have no power over. Think about that as we continue through the poem. The idea of freedom, and if it is good or bad, and in what dose. You're free now, but once you cross over into heaven, you will serve. Both God and Satan will touch on this concept throughout the poem, but in different ways. Beelzebub and Satan converse for a little bit, and then Satan calls for his angels to rise from the deep. "Awake, arise, or be forever fallen." Satan's legions rise from the depths of hell, and also the leaders, Satan's closest companions, all whose names were blotted out from God's book of life. 7 sinister-looking angelic demons would rise to his circle, and they would basically form his council. The poem gives each one a little bit of an intro and a background. The first is Moloch, horrid king, besmeared with blood of human sacrifice. There's Chemos, the obscene dread of Moab's sons. Astaroth, whom the Phoenicians call Astarte, queen of heaven with crescent horns. Thammuz came next, behind whose annual wound in Lebanon allured the Syrian damsels to lament his fate. Dagon, sea monster, upward man and downward fish. Ramon, whose delightful seat was fair Damascus on the fertile banks, and Belial came last, whom a spirit more lewd fell not from heaven, or more gross to love. I want to note after this the knowledge Milton has on past civilizations' mythology. He weaves it into the poem to help with examples, all the while buttressing up the poem with characters from the Bible, methodically just kind of weaving the story together. So with Satan's army raised, his elite evil spirits surrounding him, Satan begins his speech to basically rally his troops. Henceforth, his might we know, and know our own, so as not either to provoke or dread. New war provoked, our better part remains to work in close design by fraud or guile. What force affected not, that he no less, at length from us may find, who overcomes by force, hath overcome but half his foe. Satan ends with a clear declaration and message. For this infernal pit shall never hold celestial spirits in bondage, nor the abyss, long under darkness cover. But these thoughts, full counsel must mature. Peace is despaired. From who can think submission? War. Then war, opened or misunderstood, must be resolved. Notice the misunderstood war. Clandestine war. War without rules. Satan is not about to match God's overwhelming strength with his evil angels. He is going to attack through deception, deceit, and ambush. He knows that is the only chance he has at winning, but he's also not afraid of all-out war, if that's what it takes. Hell accepts Satan's speech, and the poem states, "And to confirm his words, out flew millions of flaming swords, drawn from the thigh of might cherubim. The sudden blaze far around illuminated hell. Highly they raged. Again, the highest and fierce, with grass arms, clashed on their sounding shields the din of war, hurling defiance toward the vault of heaven." The poem goes into gathering hell's legions and angels. The great consult is about to be held, and in book two, they will devise a plan, because Satan is about to go on the offense. And this is where book one leaves us. Before we dive into book two and hear what Satan's council decides to do, I would like to tell you about our sponsor for this video, which is Ralston College. Choosing a college does not have to be as challenging as facing Satan in Paradise Lost, but you do want to choose something that is challenging and will broaden your perspective of the world. You also want the experience to be an adventure and expand the limits of your understanding. Ralston College is currently accepting applications for its MA in Humanities. This program includes traveling to Greece for 2 months and studying ancient and modern Greek. Ralston's focus is very classically driven, with a commitment to the great works similar to the ones I cover on this channel. From reading Homer in actual Greek to experiencing a warm world with Dante, Ralston's focus on great literature is unparalleled. They have a very generous scholarship program that ensures that all admitted students can attend regardless of their financial situation. I wish I had been aware of a college like this whenever I was going through. Learning Greek and studying the classical works while being surrounded by other like-minded individuals creates an environment that you just can't find anywhere else. I have provided a link in the description below. Please go check out Ralston's website, as they have an extensive amount of information and even some free lectures they release online and via their YouTube and also through their podcast. I really want to thank Ralston for sponsoring this video. Keeping Western culture and tradition alive is something I am very passionate about, and I humbly support their mission and what they are aiming to accomplish. Applications are currently open, and the deadline is the end of April 2024, so there is not much time left for the current enrollment. But rest assured, there will be more classes offered soon. I would go check them out now. Link below, before we enter back through the gates of hell and sit down with Satan and his council, because things are about to get intense. Let's move into book two. So I'll give you a quick synopsis of book two, and then we'll actually travel through book two together. It's going to be pretty cool. The consultation with Satan and his hellish members commence. Satan debates whether they should hazard another battle with heaven. Four proposals are voiced. The fourth proposal is favored, which is basically seeking out the truth of this new world God has created. The question arises, who shall go? Satan himself undertakes the journey. The council applauds, and the meeting is adjourned. Satan then travels across the great gulf between hell and heaven. Let's begin. So Satan's angels are all around, millions of evil spirits ready to carry out the plan of whatever it is he decides. Satan is feeling empowered, and the next speech kicks off book two. Powers and dominions, deities of heaven, for since no deep within her gulf can hold immortal vigor, though oppressed and fallen, I give not heaven for lost. From the descent, celestial virtues rising will appear more glorious and more dread than from no fall, and trust themselves to fear no second fate. Satan tirades for a while, and then he ends his speech in a non-dictatorial manner, which kind of took me off guard. Satan said, "Whether of open war or covert guile, we now debate. Who can advise may speak." So the devil is seeking help. To me, this shows reason. It shows forethought. This is not egotistical. This was not a way I really expected Satan to act. Four of Satan's companions speak next, and you'll see they all have kind of a different plan of attack. Moloch, the Scepter King, is the first to stand and speak. His first lines are very clear where he stands. "My sentence is for open war." Moloch does not care about deception or deceit. He is blinded by rage. It honestly doesn't even seem that he desires a strategy. In his speech, he refers to God as the torturer, which I found ironic. Moloch is just simply searching for revenge. Belial rises next, and more graceful and humane, he speaks very well. But all was false and hollow. Though his tongue dropped to manna and could make the worst appear the better reason, to perplex and dash maturest counsels, for his thoughts were low. Belial, he's in favor of open war, but he's more worried about the outcome. Can they win? That is an important point to consider before you show up to heaven casting stones at the gate. Belial is also in favor of just staying put if needed. "A future days may bring what chance, what change worth waiting, since our present lot appears for happy though but ill, for ill not worst, if we procure not to ourselves more woe." Well, I was saying, you know, it's bad down here, but if we mess up again, it could be a lot worse. Let's chill out for a little second and think before we start pushing the path of blind revenge. And with words clothed in reason, he sits down. Mammon then arises to speak, and his speech is very formulated. He brings up God's grace, and if he would ever choose to forgive them. But then he says something that is very important. "How wearisome, eternity so spent and worship paid, to whom we hate." Even if forgiven, he would not want to go and serve God against his will. Freedom is more important to him than serving something even true and just unwillingly. Mammon says something again that would be echoed in the spirit of 76. "Free and none accountable, preferring hard liberty before the easy yoke of servile pomp." In an unadmitting way, you kind of start to root for their freedom. Who is this God that keeps them in bondage that we have not met yet? To Mammon, heaven resembles hell. The struggle is freedom at the moment. The spirits of hell just want equal status. I do not think he cares to be in full control, or I don't even really think he cares to win. Now, Satan has different plans, as we will see. Mammon, at the end of his speech, dismisses all thoughts of all-out war, advising peace for such another field they dreaded worse than hell. The last and closest of Satan's heathens rise. Old Beelzebub. And listen to how he opens his speech. It's almost in a more diplomatic way than Satan himself. "Thrones and imperial powers, offspring of heaven, ethereal virtues, or these titles now must we renounce, in changing style be called princes of hell, for so popular vote inclines, here to continue and build up here a growing empire? Doubtless." He says God did not make this dungeon a safe retreat for us. The dream of such a thing is a dream and only a dream. Beelzebub says there's no chance in winning an all-out war with heaven as well. A clandestine mission is proposed. Listen to what Beelzebub puts forth. "With dangerous expedition to invade heaven, whose high walls fear no assault or siege, or ambush from the deep, what if we find some easier enterprise? There is a place, if ancient and prophetic fame in heaven err not, another world, the happy seat of some new race, called man, about this time." Beelzebub says this place may lie exposed, like a new outpost without a garrison. This demon seems to have spotted a flaw in God's plan. By attacking these humans, they could deal a blow to God's joy, strike his heart. Beyond that, what if they can corrupt this new creation and plant the seed of Satan into this new world? The question is then brought up, who is going to partake on this despicable and unhonorable mission? Surely one of Satan's minions would be up for the task. But none would rise to the occasion, but all sat mute, pondering the danger with deep thoughts, and each in other's countenance read his own dismay, astonished. None among the choice and prime of those heaven-warring champions could be found so hardy as to prefer or accept alone the dreadful voyage till at last Satan would stand to speak. Think about what happened here. The pride of hell is not even willing to partake in a cowardly blow against heaven. Not one is willing to support the mission Satan is proposing. At this point, Satan is kind of forced to carry on the mission and accept the challenge. In my opinion, it is, or would be, an embarrassing moment for Satan. He tries to mask over it by saying he is doing it to earn the respect of his followers. And it's kind of his duty anyway, to carry out such an extreme and arduous task as this. The council ends, the satanic angels rejoice, and Satan heads out to begin his mission. He searches for the gates of hell for a while, and at last he finds it guarded by this strange half-woman, down-to-the-waist, half-serpent thing, and also a huge, undistinguishable shape. And as the dark, undistinguishable shape approaches, Satan apparently just expects to pass. Thy miscreated front, athwart my way to yonder gates. Through them, I mean to pass. Retire, or test thy folly and learn by proof, hell-born, not to contend with spirits of heaven. This big goblin recognizes that it's Satan, and calls him out as the traitorous rebel of heaven. He calls him a fugitive, and basically says if he tries to come through the gates, a strange horror will seize thee, and pangs unfelt before will commence. Satan stands unterrified, unmoved, and unshaken. The goblin and Satan both square up with the destruction of the other on their mind, hovering in the air like two dark clouds just about to collide. At this point, the half-woman creature, sitting by the gate, interjects. O Father, what intends thy hand, she cried, against thy only son? What fury, O son, possesses thee to bend thy mortal dart against thy father's head? Ho ho! Little family drama going on. Now Satan, like most men in this situation, catches a little case of the amnesia, and he replies, What thing thou art thus double-formed, and why in this infernal veil first met? Thou callest me father, and thou phantasm callest my son. I know thee not, nor ever saw till now, sight more detestable than him and thee. The portress of Hellgate is taken back, and she replies, Hast thou forgot me then? And do I seem now in thine eyes so foul, once deemed so fair? She said her womb would conceive a growing burden, and she explains in a very sick and gruesome way why she looks the way she does. And I think Milton shines here in saying the most evil things in a poetic way. The devil at this point uses this information to sweet-talk his way through the gate, promising that he comes as no enemy, but he comes to set them free. Another lie told. I questioned here why God would have the enemy guarding the gates of hell. It seems very easy to kind of be compromised. The portress then opens the gate, but she doesn't have the power to close it, so the gates of hell are officially left wide open. Satan then faces his biggest challenge yet. He has to cross the abyss between heaven and hell. Standing on the edge looking out, he ponders his journey. For no narrow frith he had to cross into this wild abyss, the womb of nature, and perhaps her grave, of neither sea nor shore nor air nor fire, but all these in their pregnant causes mixed, confusedly, and which thus must ever fight. Satan spreads his wings and dives into the birth of chaos and starts to tumble through things indescribable and dark. After hours of falling, he eventually gets caught up in a cloud and meets one Milton names Night. Night appears to be the ruler over this abyss called chaos. Satan asks for guidance to where heaven is, and he makes it clear that his only goal is revenge against God. The knight immediately recognizes him. He says, I remember your fall and your hellhounds coming through here, screaming through my chaotic world on your fall to hell. He tells him, you're not far from this new world that God has created, and he should try going there. If that way be your walk, you have not far, so much nearer danger. Go and speed, havoc and spoil and ruin are my gain. At this point, Satan has convinced every challenger he has come up against to help him. It appears Satan is not the only one that has an issue with what God has created. Satan would move on, but it is said that a bridge to hell was created to reach this new world. Tamely endured a bridge of wondrous length, from hell continued, reached the most orb of this frail world, by which the spirits perverse, with easy intercourse, pass to and fro, to tempt and punish mortal, except whom God and good angels guard by special grace. Beaten and battered, Satan enters light, and heaven comes into view, his place of origin that he had lost grace of. He also sees this new world, and he gazes on both. Right now, Satan is making strides. Hell is open, and a bridge is built for Satan's armies, legions, and demons to pass over. He is met with very little resistance getting out of hell. Night ruler over chaos in the abyss has basically supported his cause. So what lesson has Satan learned, or has he even learned one yet? So concludes book 2. As we move into book 3, we're going to see that God spots Satan, and Satan has to become more clever than ever if he wants to get past heaven's angels and corrupt the new world. God will also bring up the most important concept in regards to the fall of man. We will cover the reason why he gave us free will and how the fault does not lie with him. In book 4, we will finally meet Adam and Eve, and the poem takes a romantic dive as a demon wars against them. Thank you so much for watching, and I hope you enjoyed the first 2 books of Paradise Lost. We have 10 more books to go through, so we have quite the journey left. This is such an amazing poem. I would highly suggest you read it. It has completely changed the way I view epic poems. Now, I do not consider myself a great reader or anything by any means, but I think if you can take your time and slowly go through the poem, you can successfully read this poem. Now, there is also an audio version on Audible that has a terrific narrator. With reflection in his voice, he gets angry during the scenes with the devil. He's really, really good. It's also nice to hear the names pronounced correctly in the places, and also the old language that's kind of used in the poem. So I'll link that below in the description. You can check it out. It's a good supplement. I would say read the poem first. I read it physically first, and then I went back and listened to it. That way you have the context of the poem by reading it. And then the audio version kind of just fill in any of the blanks and stuff like that. If you want to purchase some of my coffee, the link is always in the description below. You can use the code THECAUS for 15% off your first order. All these videos can be found in podcast form. Please don't forget to check out Roston College. Drink some amazing coffee, read some amazing books, and I will see you next week as we will be discussing books 3 and 4, Paradise Lost. Thank you so much for tuning in. I love you. Stay blessed.
I was making lots of noise, busking on the city streets. I came back from Brooklyn, but you didn't come back for me.